Welcome back to another episode of The Witch Doctor, a serial fiction podcast brought to you by me, Aquanimous Rex. Honestly, I have to say, wow, you guys, I'm not sure what did it, but my downloads have, relatively speaking, skyrocketed over the last week or so. I'm glad that this project is attracting more ears, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to entertain. If you're interested in helping the podcast out, without having to spend a penny, consider stopping for a moment and leaving a review on iTunes or other podcast apps. It only takes a second of your time, but by leaving a review, you'll help make it easier for other people to find The Witch Doctor on their own. Likewise, you can find me on Facebook or Twitter at my writer's page under Aquanimous Rex. Let's get to this week's episode, and thank you for listening. The Witch Doctor, Episode 22, The Worm. The soul seems to take on the shape of its perceptions, and as such, a soul may be a kind of receptacle, and as such, it may be that spirits are a kind of impression, or make use of impressions, and that they imprint upon the souls of men orders and charges with which to spur them onward in the direction and towards the actions deemed necessary to the spirit. These impressions, which do in turn alter and push a person in this direction or that, are the crux of a person's character. The soul, pure though it may be in a refined or innocent state, is the fountainhead from which springs forth our memories, our imaginings, our decisions, and innumerable other ephemeral qualities. The angels and demons which seek to impress themselves upon the soul may not be able to wholly corrupt a man, though they surely try, but nevertheless they are capable of great distortions. The pious always claim to be immune from such manipulations, until they are under the thumb of a powerful and malignant demon, after which they are deemed to be impure and impious, ex post facto. I have seen, though I tremble to put these thoughts into letters, men who have had every memory stolen from them, men who have had their senses blunted or destroyed, their faculty of reason broken, their bodies living and yet bereft of any signs of spiritual or soulful ecstasy. These imps and beasts of hellfire do not seem to have any barrier stopping them from utter domination of their human prey, save for the uncanny and fey rules and laws of their own, by which one may successfully bind them, banish them, and perhaps even destroy them. Excerpt from Der Hexendoctor, The Witch Doctor's Guidebook, written by an anonymous heretic philosopher, 1484. When Jack Knave was a child, before he was Jack Knave at all and was instead Little Jackie Lafayette, he had been plagued by nightmares. Frequently, he would scream into the night, his parents rushing up into his room to comfort him with soft words and reassurances. Had these events been infrequent, they may have been forgotten with time, unimportant and normal blips in an otherwise normal child's life. Had they been proper night terrors, they would have left no residue in the skull of the boy, greasy and sticking and leaving him with haunting memories of hopeless and visceral horror. But these were not night terrors, and so the boy did not forget them upon awakening. He carried the nightmares around with him. When he would get up for breakfast, they were there. When he went to the small local schoolhouse to learn his rudimentary math and history, the memories would claw him behind his eyes, would nip and bite and scratch the second he dropped his defenses. Young Jack's eyes had begun to grow glazed, began to darken around his sockets. When his appetite all but disappeared, his eyes began to look as though they were being sucked into his skull. His mother had taken him to the town physician, who had found nothing wrong with the boy. They would end up visiting the doctor many more times, and the results would always be the same. "There's nothing physically wrong with the child. He's just, you know, trauma has a way of impacting your health. Jack just needs some rest, and he needs to eat more. Other than that, all you can do is love him and be there for him," the physician had told his parents. But good, deep sleep would not come. "It's a damn shame what happened. You're in our thoughts and prayers, all of ours. We're here for you if you need us," the physician had added. But the town wasn't there for them. How could it be? What remedies did they have for the ailment that Jack carried within him? He was not ill in body. Their prayers did nothing to stop what came when the sun set.
"The worm! The worm! Mom, the worm! Dad, the worm! The worm! It's eating me! It's in me! It's inside me! It's chewing! It's biting! The worm! It's in me! It's in me! It's in me! It's in me!"
And on it went, until his parents woke young Jack up fully so that he would sob and ask them why the worm wasn't dead, why the worm had come back for him, why the doctors hadn't managed to kill it. But of course, the worm was dead, just like his sister. Neurocysticercosis was the official diagnosis. A calcified tapeworm lodged in her brain, caught far too late to do anything about it. Which had been a blessing of sorts, as the Lafayette family, extended and nuclear, collectively would not have been able to afford the price of transportation, let alone the medical procedure. An expensive surgery which would have been necessary to save little Abigail Lafayette. Catching the tapeworm too late relieved them somewhat of a sense of culpability, though they would not realize this for a long time. They grieved, as families do. But soon, another predicament foisted itself upon the family.
"Daddy, why can't you make the worm leave me alone? Please make it stop. Please, please, Daddy, please make the worm go away,"
the boy had pleaded with his father. But his dad couldn't stop the worm. The worm which came upon Jack night after night, wriggling and burrowing, making scuttling, sloshing noises in his brain. Jack would sleep, and the worm would come alive. Sometimes it even left the confines of his cerebrum to dart around his room, to stare at Jack from dark corners and from beneath his bed. The worm would hiss and taunt him, gleefully giggling at the thought of killing Jack's sister. His parents couldn't stop the worm. The local pastor couldn't pray it away. The doctors didn't have a medicine, and Jack's parents were too terrified of what the animedics might find if they were involved. His parents would spare him that shame as long as they could. They worried their son was perhaps schizophrenic or otherwise mentally ill. The Lafayettes were not a superstitious family, and while they would dutifully espouse support for the devout and their legislations, they were not especially religious. They knew that if all else failed, that Jack would be put away in a low-security sanatorium spiritus, tended to by those creepy mind-breakers that had dethroned traditional therapists and psychiatrists. The animedics, with all of their zeal, were perhaps the most intimidating of the Council of Fellowship's minions, second only to the Witchfinders, of whom neither Jack nor his family had ever encountered, only having heard the same dark rumors and violent gossip as everybody else about the Finders and their methodologies. But unlike the Witchfinders, animedics were not rare, and more people were being sent to their care every year. Jack's parents had no faith in these soul surgeons, and yet they were no help to their son. and his ailment persisted. One night, hours after Jack had settled into bed, he was awoken by a soft voice. Fearing the worm, he hid beneath his blanket, eyes wide open and darting around, though he could see nothing from underneath the warm confines of his bedding. A floorboard creaked right beside him, and Jack had frozen in terror.
"Boy, you may come out. The worm has been restrained. I am a friend."
This was not the reedy, inhuman voice of the worm come to taunt and cajole, but someone new. Jack had lowered the blanket just above his nose and peered into the dark space of his bedroom. Standing in the middle of the floor was a man that Jack had never seen before. His face was obscured by shadows, but Jack could see that the man had long, swept-back black hair and a sharply pointed goatee. The man wore a bright red overcoat, which stood out starkly even without light. It was cinched at the waist and fell to the man's ankles, revealing simple leather boots. Black fur lined the crimson cuffs of the long coat, poofing out slightly. Jack had never witnessed an article of clothing quite like that before, but it gave the impression of antiquity, of the times spoken of in story and fable long before Jack's birth. It seemed to whisper of frozen, barren lands. One of the man's gloved hands was holding aloft the worm. His fingers were sunk into the disgusting thing, which wriggled and squirmed, bigger than most of the neighborhood dogs, and yet the man held it up with no obvious effort.
"Has this creature been bothering you, lad?"
the man asked, though Jack could not see his mouth move, and the words seemed to drip from the ceiling. He nodded, still not taking his eyes from the impenetrable darkness masking the man's distinct features.
"I can get rid of it for you, if you'd like. This beast will never bother you again, should you wish it."
Young Jack, lying in his bed, didn't hesitate.
"Please!"
he nearly shouted, sitting up quickly, the blanket falling from his face. The man studied the boy for a moment, or so Jack had assumed, being unable to see the stranger's eyes.
"There is payment. Something that you have that I want,"
the man told him. Jack, not understanding, had remained silent.
"When you go to the store, do you simply walk in and grab whatever you want and leave? When you go to the doctor, do you demand that they treat you without compensation?"
the man in the red coat asked the boy, who slowly shook his head in response.
I don't have any money,"
Jack whimpered. The worm jerked suddenly, hissing, trying to face the boy, who uttered a small scream and pulled his blanket back up around the lower half of his face. The man jerked the worm hard, and it went mostly still, though not dead, as Jack might have wished, its tendrils and appendages twitching still.
"I have no use for money, boy. What you have is something far, far more valuable to me, but which you will not miss in the slightest once it is gone. If you want me to get rid of this worm for you, you must give me memory."
The man leaned in, and Jack could now see his sallow, scarred face and unicolored white eyes, as if the man was blind, though blind he did not act. A hooked nose, sunken cheeks, a grandiose mustache to go with the pointed goatee.
"One memory. At the end of every year, for the rest of your life. If you give me this, I will get rid of this worm and it will never come back. What do you say, boy?
Jack's mind had raced.
Are you the devil?
The boy asked meekly. The man reared back and cackled dryly, a noise nearly unrecognizable as laughter.
No, I am not the devil. I am a humble collector, that is all. And one who can help you with your...
The man shook the worm once more, and it made a strange bleeding noise.
Bug problem. The choice is yours, boy. I cannot force your memories from you. They can only be given over willfully. So tell me what it will be. I have places to go and people to see. I could always leave the worm here while you make up your mind.
The man lowered the creature slowly, hesitantly, in a show of urgency. Jack sat up straight and raised his hands pleadingly.
No, I'll do it, I promise.
The man in the red coat had nodded and turned and left the bedroom. A screeching noise could be heard from the hallway adjacent, and Jack wondered for the first time why his parents had not woken up from all the commotion. A second later, the man in the red coat returned. The worm was nowhere to be seen. A second later, the man in the red coat returned. The worm was nowhere to be seen. Now in the stranger's gloved hands was a small, crude notebook and a bedraggled, ratty-looking quill. The iridescent feather looked to have belonged to an abnormally large raven.
Hold still now, boy. This will be over in a moment.
The man had pressed the tip of the quill into the top of young Jack's head, painlessly. When he had pulled it away, strange, faintly glowing ink covered the tip, and the man began to scribble, scratching at the grimy paper of his notebook for an indefinite period of time. Jack had said nothing, and soon the man, without word, had left his room. Jack was back to dreamless sleep in under a minute. The worm did not return. Young Jack Lafayette's sudden amnesia in regard to his sister's death did little to help heal the wounds his parents bore, still open and fresh. But Jack started to eat, and he did not scream out into the night any longer. Not even plagued by the normal, everyday nightmares children often face when the lights have been snuffed and their guardians retire to their own beds. Jack would be a heavy, deep sleeper for the rest of his childhood, often recalling no dreams at all, save for occasional exceptions, one of which would reoccur once a year, every year, which he would only ever half remember upon awakening, and would usually forget entirely before breakfast. His memory problems would vex him, and continue, for the rest of his childhood and beyond. For the most part, these lapses in memory rarely affected Jack. He had no problems with semantic memory and retained all sorts of facts and information he picked up in school or books. But his autobiographical, episodic memories were subject to loss over time, it seemed. Forgetting how his sister had passed away was the hardest for Jack and his family to deal with, but for years and years after, mostly the lost memories consisted of trivial things. It was sad, to be sure, for Jack's parents to realize that their son had completely forgotten a family dinner, or that a wintertime crush they had seen their son develop would evaporate the new year just begun. But compared to that initial forgetting, the lost memories were rarely of utmost importance. The oddly particular amnesia wasn't really a problem, until one day, it was. Jack was 17, and he did not know why everyone was suddenly afraid of him, disgusted by him. His parents wouldn't, or couldn't, explain to him what had happened. Eventually, not knowing drove Jack into a fury, and he had confronted the town pastor about it, trying to squeeze the information from the portly, timid man. But after the pastor had laid out exactly what had occurred, in tones of moral superiority and condemnation, Jack walked out of the church, and never again did he return there. And not an hour later, Jack packed a bag, left a note for his folks, and walked out of Milton, the town he had lived in his entire life, without looking back. Leaving behind his family, he only felt it right to leave behind his name, resolving to forevermore introduce himself as Jack Knave, a play on words he thought especially clever. With a bit of the money he had saved up doing odd jobs around town, Jack purchased a tent and the most basic of camping supplies. He wandered around the Northwestern Territories for a few months but grew worried about the cold. It had been a mild winter, but the air was already turning sharp and razor-like and frosted. Jack spent a couple of months in a rundown suburb off of the Gray Stacks, somewhere near where Philadelphia might have been once upon a time. But Jack was driven out after a contraband dealer had become convinced that Jack had slept with his mistress. The dealer wasn't incorrect, and Jack made sure to get as far away from the area as possible. The cityscapes were vast and treacherous, stretching the entire span of the Dominion, bisecting the poor and rundown northern territories from the prosperous southern, the wastes to the west. Much of the Gray Stacks were abandoned, entire sections of the urban sprawl left to squatters, mugger gangs, blasphemers, and prostitutes, many of which Jack befriended, having little of value for them to covet. Jack had tried to move further south, but kept getting caught up in the density and labyrinthine micropolitics found in nearly every neighborhood he walked through. The people were clannish and suspicious, but for good reason. More than once, Jack had been walking down the street in some Gray Stack neighborhood, only to see dozens of BDs in dark tactical gear and expressionless black masks, armed to the teeth with supposedly less lethal armaments. They would swarm into an apartment building and round up 100 people or so at a time, under suspicion of heresy, diablerie, or tithe evasion. The ritzy, exclusive sections of the Gray Stacks, lined with fences and walls and armed guards, were outside of Jack's reach. They were safer neighborhoods, but only to those who could afford them. Jack would sometimes camp out in a tall, decrepit building and watch the bright lights and nightlife of these micro-cities with vague, undefined envy. When the weather had warmed, Jack headed back up north, catching a ride with a band of traders heading towards the less populous Northeastern Territories, or the NT as locals called it. The merchants were eager for an extra pair of eyes and hands, their crew diminished as it was by the cold season. The monetary incentive for procuring cheap cooking and heating fuel, in the form of dried and cured logs purchased from the NT, propelled them. These territories were notoriously hazardous in the winter, but the lands were bipolar, full of verdant and lush forests in the summer, and were the primary source of lumber and fuel for many in this part of the Dominion. Deciduous and coniferous forests both grew into and outside of one another. Jack eventually bade farewell to his caravan and wandered freely forth. There were few townships, but enough that Jack could wander in and find temporary work. The people were often cautious of outsiders, but warmed magnanimously once a stranger was vetted by enough of the town. Jack stayed the longest in a tiny, unnamed settlement set up by half a dozen woodcutters for themselves and their families. They would trade with nearby townships who would bring carts or rigorously maintained off-road vehicles full of potatoes and pickled summertime foodstuffs. And through this barter system, Jack was able to earn keep under a lumberman's roof and 2 meals a day. And then, almost 1 year after he had left Milton, on New Year's Eve, the man in the red overcoat returned, as he did every year. This time, however, when the collector leaned over to press his quill into Jack's skull, Jack swatted it away, sending the feather flying. Jack had stood up, rage building in his head, and he had flipped off the man in the red coat with both hands and told him to get the fuck out. Jack was too angry to be scared of the man anymore, furious at the choice of memory that he had taken from Jack. Without that particular memory, it could be said accurately that there was no living witness to the event which had turned his town against him. Jack had struggled with unsurety for a year, never knowing the truth about what had happened. There were only rumors, and of the people who had been there to see it, only Jack still drew breath. He harnessed his rage, and every ounce of it went into holding 2 middle fingers up at the white-eyed collector, who had scowled, turned, and walked away. Jack had woken up in a sweat, already starting to forget what had transpired. It would not be long before the worm would return. His nighttime struggles and screams made his host nervous, and Jack began camping out except during the worst freezes. When the weather warmed, he left the woodcutter settlement behind, the lumberman cordial but obviously relieved. One of them told Jack that he should find a devout reverend and ask God for mercy. Jack thanked the man and said that he would, but he knew better. If he went to the devout now, he would be locked up at best. Low security if he left out the part about making a pact with what was obviously some kind of demon. The nocturnal visitations easier to recollect after telling the collector to fuck off. After the worm had returned. Nowhere else to turn, Jack secluded himself, away from other people, only venturing out into towns when he absolutely required it to survive. He began to look sickly again. It unnerved people, which Jack could understand, being quite a bit unnerved by the sight of himself he would glimpse sometimes in puddles of water, or the odd mirror or reflective window pane. The months stretched on, feeling endless. Jack was driven into a nearly feral state. His longest stretch without proper human interaction was brought to an end one day in a town Jack could not remember the name of, by a kind, matronly woman who told Jack that her sister was married to one of the woodcutters at the quasi-village he had stayed at, and that she had heard of Jack before. She told him, in all earnestness, that he should get himself to a witch doctor, and that there was one over in Benetton, and that this witch doctor would be able to heal him, and he'd never have to utter a word to the devout. Jack thanked her, even cried a bit, and took off in the direction of the town. The witch doctor, a greasy-haired middle-aged man who went by the unlikely moniker of Christian Solomon, had told the ragged and dirty Jack that he would be able to banish the worm easily enough in exchange for a few months' labor. But when Jack had mentioned the collector, going into great detail about the strange being, Mr. Solomon had shaken his head and declared, with finality, that there was nothing the witch doctor could do for Jack.
"You fucked up, kid. You made a pact with a spirit. Set up a vinculum. A link. I'm not saying it's impossible to block him or even suppress him, but you're the only one who's going to be able to sever that bond. I'm sorry. It's a real raw deal."
But Jack was not content with that answer, and begged to be taught how to exorcise himself of the foul thing, the white-eyed collector, and his bond.
It's not something you can just do overnight, you know. It's gonna take years, years of work, and you'll be a liability. There's a reason you don't see a witch doctor in every town, you know. The devout want my balls on a silver platter. But fine, I'll teach you. But you need to understand the hazards of the job.
And so Jack Knave began his preternatural tutelage under the witch doctor he would eventually betray, staying with him for years before his treacherous theft of the object most valuable to the man who would become to Jack akin to a second father. These memories, save for those which had been cut out of Jack's soul by the red-coated man, flashed before him as he hung in the endless abyss between worlds, just having left behind Noel and the present. They repeated themselves, over and over, and Jack merely watched them, silent. The holes in his void birth biography were almost as painful as the aftermath they had wreaked upon his life.
"So you have come back, then,"
a familiar voice uttered in the undarkness.
"Have you reconsidered my offer? Will you give me the book?"
The collector appeared before him, looking the same as he ever had, floating in the empty space Jack was likewise suspended in. The spirit's white, blind-looking eyes locked on to the young man.
"Did you do this to the town? Did you take the children? Are you trying to punish me?"
Jack asked, without moving lips he no longer possessed. The collector did not move, his voice similarly projected all around the two of them.
"No, I did not do this to the town. No, I did not take the children. But yes, punish you I must. You are the one who broke the pact, who decided to step all over my investment in you. When you first came to me, those weeks ago, I told you what I needed and you refused."
Jack didn't need to be reminded of the first time he had used the isolation tank successfully, and he wished he could attack this thing. But Jack knew he did not have the skills to do so, not in this non-place.
"You wanted me to trigger a limnus event in a town full of people. My memories aren't worth that, and you know it."
The collector cackled, dry and hoarse.
"Your memories are worth what you will pay for them, boy. The limnus was necessary for the transaction of the book. But I did not create this one. This town, this place, was already on the verge. That's why you picked it."
The demon pointed a finger towards Jack's consciousness. "You said we needed a location where the membrane was thin, not punctured. I never agreed to this fuckery," Jack protested.
"You told me you'd take care of it, if I wouldn't. And now you're claiming you had nothing to do with it? I bet, you lying shit, you lying piece of shit."
The collector lowered his accusatory finger.
"Believe what you will, human. I did not sever the membrane. I do not have that power. But..."
The spirit paused, letting Jack focus on his words.
"I do know two things. I know who caused the limnus. I also know that right now, a man who intends to kill you is standing over your body. Get me the book, boy, and I'll tell you how to stop the limnus. I'll tell you where the children are and who caused the strife. I will return your memories. I will leave you alone. But decide quickly, or you will not be alive to make the transaction."
And with that, the void faded, and the isolation tank Jack was suspended in came back into sensory focus around him. Jack heard a gunshot, and he ripped away the cloth tied around his eyes, and saw a nearly naked masked man standing on the rim of the makeshift pool, holding a gun against his leg now, and sobbing.
I didn't know,
the man cried, and Jack swung around in the water, feet planted against the wooden planks just beneath the now taut tarpaulin floor of the isolation tank, looking beyond the masked man, beyond the gun, to where Rebecca and Sarah Siegel were huddled against a blood-splattered wall, Sarah bleeding profusely and gasping. Not understanding, not needing to understand, Jack, charcoal-drawn pentagram still visible on his forehead, grasped the man's skinny legs, pulling them back toward the water. Abram crashed, his chest hitting the wooden framework, the gun clattering to the garage floor. Jack heaved, and Abram went into the water face first, flailing his arms beneath the liquid, unable to lift himself out or gain purchase. Ankles in hand, arms bulging with the effort required to stop Abram from kicking out of his grip, Jack held the older man upside down, drowning him. This has been The Witch Doctor, Episode 22, The Worm, by Equanimous Rex. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for future episodes. Music attribution. The intro is Come Play With Me by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. The outro is Iron Horse, also by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. Both of the songs are licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license.